Just a couple of points before we go back into the meditation. So in the shamatha practice we're doing at the moment is we're observing the mind and whatever is arising in the mind. And with this practice, often some analogies are given to help us better understand what we're doing in this practice. And one analogy that's sometimes given is that our mind is like a stage, and that all the thoughts and mental events are like actors on the stage. And that we are observing this play going on. Of course, normally in our life, we're not observing the play, we are caught up in it. And that's why we have a lot of imbalances in our life, because we're caught up in the play of our life. And so here then, the stage is what's called the background, and then the actors on the stage, of course, are the foreground. And the foreground, or the actors, or the mental events, can have a sort of two flavors to them. Some of these mental events are more objective in nature. Things like thoughts, memories, mental images are more objective. We experience them more objectively. And some mental events we experience more subjectively. Things like emotions, desires, moods, intentions. These are much more subjective in nature. And because of that, they tend to be more sticky. They tend to be more difficult to not get caught up in. And also sometimes, because they're more subjective, when we are looking at the play, we tend to miss them. We tend to be just looking at the more objective events, the thoughts, emotions, memories. And so sometimes, you know, we're looking there and there doesn't seem to be much there and we're getting really frustrated, but we don't notice the frustration because it's very subjective. So what we're going to do in this meditation is we are going to do the same practice of observing the mind and whatever's coming up, but we're going to break it into two parts. First half of the, of course we're going to do two sessions, but in the first of 20 minute session, half of that we're going to begin by just looking at the more objective mental events, thoughts, memories, mental images. And then we're going to deliberately shift in the second half to look at the more subjective mental events, which we often overlook and often we get caught up in more easily. So we're going to then look at emotions and desires and moods and intentions and so forth. And then, of course, another analogy that's often used is the sky and the clouds, which I think I already mentioned. You know, the mind is like the sky and the thoughts and all the mental events are like clouds moving through the sky. And then also, of course, then sometimes when we're looking at the sky or at the stage, there's no clouds or the actors have gone off the stage. So this is, we're looking at the space of the mind itself. And so often, of course, as a beginner, we have many things coming up, one thought after another. And so because they all seem to be mainly always there, we don't actually see the stage or the sky. You know, it's like a cloudy day, completely cloudy day. We don't see the sky. So in the second half of the 20 minutes, we're going to also look objectively, subjectively, but then we're going to look at the stage, the sky, or sometimes what's called the gap between thoughts. Once we get deeper into the practice, instead of thoughts all the time, they're going to slow down. And then we're going to find between when one thought stops and the next one starts, there's a gap. And in that gap is the stage, is the sky. So we're going to purposely focus on that in the second part a little bit, just to sort of be more clearly aware of that. So that's what we're going to do in these two sessions. So let's do the practice, and then I want to comment a little bit more about that, and then I'm sure there's also questions after the meditation. But first, let's do the practice. Settling the body into a state of relaxation, stillness, and vigilance. Allowing the breathing to flow naturally and effortlessly. Letting go of any expectations or concerns regarding the practice. Simply allowing the mind to rest in the present moment. Focusing on the sensations of the breath throughout the body. with your eyes at least partially open, vacantly resting your gaze in the space in front of you. Bring your attention to your own mind and observe your own mind. And initially, primarily focus on the more objective mental events. That is, things like thoughts and memories and mental images. Observing them as they arise and pass, without grasping to them, without becoming distracted. Now shift your focus slightly and now emphasize focusing on the more subjective mental events. Things like emotions, moods, desires. So look at the current state of your mind, particularly noticing if any mental afflictions are arising, any aversion, craving, frustration. Whatever is arising, simply observe it, not trying to block it, not following it. Once again, keeping the back straight and allowing the body to become completely relaxed. Bringing the mind into the present moment. Focusing on the sensations of the breath throughout the body. With the eyes at least partially open, now bring your attention to your own mind. And be like an impartial observer or witness, observing the mental events which arise in the space of your mind. And again, initially emphasizing the more objective mental events, such as thoughts, memories, mental images. shift your focus slightly and emphasize the more subjective mental events, such as emotions, moods, desires. Looking at the current state of your mind. Now, if you find that you're simply getting caught up in your emotions all the time, then you might like to experiment with labeling, giving them a name, and see if that helps you to get some distance from them, not to get caught up in them. shift your focus from the foreground to the background. So now primarily focus on the space of the mind, the space where mental events appear, where they abide, and into which they dissolve. So now primarily focusing on the space of the mind. There's one more point I'd like to bring up regarding this practice and also actually the Vipassana practice. And I'd like to begin by reading a little bit from Alan Wallace again, from his Attention Revolution, because he brings this point up as well. And he says the following: one of the more common challenges in this practice is the emergence of fear. As you release your grip on the contents of the mind, you are undermining your normal sense of personal identity, which is constantly reinforced by thinking, by recalling, and identifying with your personal history, hopes, and plans. Now you are disengaging from these familiar supports for substantiating your ego. As lapses between thoughts occur more and more frequently, and for longer periods your awareness hovers in a kind of empty space, a vacuum devoid of personhood, you may come into the grip of fear as your normal sense of who you are loses its footing. The teacher Genlam Rinpa warned his students that such dread may well arise during their training. It is crucial, he counseled, not to identify with it, nor give it any credence. Some kinds of fear are based in reality. They protect us from danger, filling the body with energy so that we can flee or protect ourselves in whatever way necessary. But this kind of dread, with no clear object, has no such basis in reality. There is no danger in the empty, luminous space of awareness. You have nothing to lose but your false sense of an independent, controlling ego. The only thing being threatened is an illusion. If you don't identify with it, there's nothing to fear. If you do identify with this fear, it may bring your entire practice to a grinding halt and throw you into deep emotional imbalances. So it is of utmost importance to observe such fear without distraction and without grasping. Keep to the essentials of the practice. Another emotional imbalance that may crop up at any time during this training is depression, which may be related to a deep-rooted sense of guilt and low self-esteem. When any of these emotions or attitudes arise during meditation sessions, treat them like any other mental event. Watch their emergence, see how they linger, and then observe them disappear back into the space of the mind. Examine them with a discerning intelligence, but without any emotional charge. Rather than identifying with them or owning them, let them emerge from the space of awareness and dissolve back without any intervention on your part, even without any preference for them to go away. Let the space of your mind be emotionally neutral, like physical space, which could not care less whether bullets or hummingbirds streak through it. So I think this is some very good advice, and this is something very common in this practice and the Vipassana practice, particularly when we're observing the mind. You know, if we have a good posture and settle the body well, and we can sort of forget about the body, then often even a strong sense of body sort of dissipates because it's comfortable and we're focusing on the mind. Because our normal sense of identity is being constantly reinforced, often by a sense of a solid body, but also our sense of identity is constantly being reinforced by mental events, our thoughts, our emotions, our history, our plans, all of these things keep reinforcing our sense of identity, as does a solid body. If in meditation, again, if we have a nice, comfortable posture and we're focusing on looking at the mind, the sense of a solid body can dissolve. And then, of course, when we're looking at the mind and we're not getting caught up in our mental events, they'll start to subside. And more often, as he said, you'll find there'll be this gap, this space. So now there's no solid sense of body and there's no mental events reinforcing the sense of me. And so then often people come into fear because their normal sense of me is dissolving. And so they interpret this open, spacious awareness, misinterpret it to feel like, oh, I'm going out of existence. And so we develop a lot of fear. But as he said, this fear is not based in reality. It's irrational fear. There's nothing to fear in that open, spacious stillness. The only thing dissolving is a false sense of me. A false sense of me that actually is the root of all of our suffering. And so if we can understand that, we can simply stay in that open, spacious state. So this is quite a common experience in this practice, but also, of course, a very common experience in the Vipassana practice that we're going to start looking at tomorrow. The same idea is that the solid sense, the basis for solid sense of me dissolves. And then, in fact, this is the in Vipassana practice, the emptiness experience is that experience. It's an experience of not finding this me. And so, of course, when people first enter into this practice and they come to this emptiness experience, which is a valid experience, they often misinterpret that experience to mean I'm going out of existence or I don't really exist. And then they get caught up in fear. But again, this fear is completely irrational fear. So this is something I think we need to keep in mind in both the shamatha and vipassana practice, and I'm going to talk more about it again when we go into the vipassana practice tomorrow. So any questions about this practice that we've done this morning?
Regarding losing the existence of me, which may cause an injury you have just talked about.
Sure.
So this is an accomplishment. Can we say that it's an accomplishment?
What's an accomplishment?
During the meditation, it's a stage that when we reach...
In the shamatha practice?
Yes, it's
yeah, because remember, we are focusing in this case on the mind. And the more that we focus on this, I think I briefly mentioned it yesterday, the more we can be focused on this, the more actually our sense faculties begin to become dormant. So not only will we then not have a solid sense of body, we won't really hear sounds and so forth because we're absorbed in looking at the mind. And then, of course, when we're looking at the mind and not getting caught up in mental events, then slowly they'll start to subside and slowly we'll have more and more periods of no mental activity. And normally our sense of identity is constantly being reinforced by a sense of a solid body and mental activity that's reinforcing the sense of me normally. So when there's no solid sense of solid body, there's no mental activity reinforcing this sense of me, then we just have the open, spacious awareness. So that is, of course, a sign of progress that we are not getting distracted by the body, sounds and so forth, and that we are focused on the mind and the mental activity starts to subside, because the goal of this shamatha practice is to have a calm, clear, focused mind. So when we have that state, of course, assuming that we're not just half asleep and nothing's registering, I'm talking now about a clear state of mind, then yes, it is a sign that we're progressing. But again, what often happens is when people first start having these experiences, they misinterpret this experience to mean, oh, there's no me, because there's nothing reinforcing the sense of me. And so they develop a lot of fear. But that fear is completely irrational fear, because the only thing that's dissolving is a false sense of me. So if we understand that, and we can better understand that by developing the correct view of reality, which we're going to look at in the Vipassana practice, then when we get to that experience, we won't misinterpret that experience, we won't develop any fear, and we'll just continue in the practice using that as a signpost that we're actually going in a good direction. Possibly, yeah, sure.
Yes, but if there is something good about that, so why keep eyes open?
Something good about...
Losing the sense of the body, if there is something good about that.
Right. So, I mean, that's a side effect, of course. Yeah, it's a side effect, and it's good because then we don't get distracted by things in the body. And... again, with the eyes closed, the difficulty with the eyes closed here is that generally with our eyes closed, we fall into dullness. And also, remember, this practice is the basis for Vipassana practice. And in Vipassana practice, the goal is to realize emptiness, to realize non-duality. And with the eyes closed, we're sort of reinforcing the false sense of me in here, world out there. The sense of subject-object duality is stronger with the eyes closed because we have a sense of me in here and then there's a world out there.
When you close your eyes, you just shut the world, you shut the outer world.
Correct, but then you have a strong sense of me in here. If you have your eyes open, the sense of inside and outside is not as strong. And also, of course, better clarity. And also, remember, in this practice here, we're trying to observe the mind and all the mental events. So if we're meditating doing that with our eyes closed and we get used to observing thoughts with the eyes closed, then in daily life, it's not going to be so easy to observe thoughts because we're not used to observing thoughts with our eyes open. We've only ever done it with our eyes closed in meditation. Whereas if we meditate with the eyes open and get in the habit of observing thoughts with eyes open in meditation, then in daily life, it's going to be much easier to do that in daily life. So it varies, very helpful to transition to daily life.
Why should we do that in daily life?
Because what we do now is we get caught up in our thoughts and our thoughts overwhelm us. We get caught up in our stories. That's what we do now. If we can observe all the mental events in daily life, then they won't overwhelm us. We won't develop all the problems from getting caught up in our stories.
But when you meditate, you can't do anything else. I wouldn't be able to live in the state of meditation. Because when you meditate, you're concentrated on one object.
Correct.
And thoughts, when we observe thoughts in meditation, they are not very normal. They are short. Like you cut them.
No, you don't cut them.
When you don't feed them, they are becoming very short and very they're just flowing. So in daily life, you couldn't function if you would just be concentrated on your thoughts. You couldn't.
No, it's not like that. It's not like that. It's that it means in daily life that if we practice this shamatha well, we will be more focused on whatever we're doing. Because now in daily life, we try to focus on something and then some thought comes up and we get caught up in that and we get distracted on what we're supposed to be trying to do. That's what happens now. If we do this meditation well, we can be better focused on what we're doing and not get distracted by our thoughts.
So that's for people who feel lack of focus in their life.
That's everybody. No? You're completely focused in daily life.
It's enough.
Yeah. Wouldn't you like to be better focused? Wouldn't you like to be more calm, more effective, less stress, less agitation? Wouldn't you like to have that in daily life? If you're satisfied with your current level, that's fine. That's okay. But I think most people would like to be more focused, more calm, less agitated, less stressed, more effective in their life. Well, that's a good side effect, of course. Yeah, I mean, we can do this practice for all sorts of purposes. I mean, but again, the main purpose of this practice is to develop a calm, clear, focused mind so that we can penetrate the nature of reality, so we can eliminate all of our mental afflictions and never have suffering again. That's the purpose, the long-term purpose. Short-term benefit, of course, is this. Okay, any other questions? Yeah.
About this fear.
This
fear is very real.
The fear is real, the object of fear is doesn't exist.
But when it comes, and then when you feel it, then it brings you back into the body. Because I feel it, it also, it raises my pulse.
Sure.
And it can cause spasms in the hand.
Sure.
Sure. So what it is it that it tries to bring you back into your ego, or it is just like side effect?
It's a side effect, yes, because the fear causes then the grasping to be stronger.
Don't go further. And this fear tells you that don't go further and stop, don't go.
Yeah, I mean, it's like if there's some danger, as he said, sometimes some fear is good because it protects us from danger, makes us alert towards danger. But here the problem is there's no danger, we think there's danger. And that's why fear is generated. We think we don't exist or we're going out of existence, but that is completely irrational. It's like fearing something that's not out there. It's irrational fear. So what to do, of course, is a couple of things with this. One is through our study and reflection, at least intellectually, we can understand that this fear that's coming up is irrational. You know, it's like a little child, you know, is afraid because the boogeyman is in the cupboard at night, you know, that there's someone hiding in the cupboard. And then, of course, the mother goes, opens the cupboard and goes, look, there's no one there. And slowly, slowly, then the child understands that this fear is completely irrational and can overcome it. So similarly here, it's very helpful then to reflect on the fact that there is nothing to fear through our understanding of who we really are, particularly in the Vipassana practice. So that's one thing we can do. The second thing we can do, particularly as Alan Wallace recommended here in the text, is if fear starts to come up in this practice, then like every other mental event, observe the fear. Because as long as you are observing that which is provoking the fear, you keep feeding the fear. So if fear arises, shift your focus, well, it should be on there anyway because that's the practice, is just observe the fear directly. Because if you're observing the fear directly, you're no longer observing the thing that is causing the fear. So there's nothing feeding the fear anymore. So then there's nowhere for the fear to go. So this is another thing we can do with this. And there was one other thing I wanted to mention. Slip my mind now. It'll come. Yeah.
It is exactly what, because I'm very, very beginning.
Sure.
It's like yesterday when I told you. I went into it and I felt that it will kill me because it was so big. It filled all this room and upper part of the body.
Sure.
And it gave feeling like panic.
Sure.
And then I started to study this panic.
To watch the panic.
And panic came on. But not this field. It stayed. It was very, very frightening. I felt it again. I feel it in my hands.
Sure.
I feel it in my body.
Sure. So again, in the longer term, what we need to do is to really to come to understand that this fear is irrational fear, that there's no basis for this fear in reality, that we're fearing something that doesn't... We're fearing going out of existence, and we're not going out of existence. The only thing going out of existence is a false sense of me. Again, as Alan Wallace said, there's nothing to fear in the open, spacious stillness of awareness. So we need to slowly come to appreciate that, and then slowly, slowly, when we have that experience, we won't misinterpret it and develop fear. So that's something we need to work on in the longer term. Okay. Sure. So again, if fear or worry about some physical problem actually helped to alleviate it, I would say have as much fear or worry as you can. But the reality is, fear or worry about a physical problem only exacerbates it. It only makes it bigger because we're having aversion to it. So therefore, if we can follow Shanti Deva's advice, it would be helpful. And he says, if a situation can be remedied, why get upset? Means if you have a physical ailment and you can do something about it, take some medicine or something, just fix it. Don't need to worry, just fix it. And if it's if the situation cannot be remedied, what's the point in getting upset? So if you have a physical ailment that cannot be cured, then what's the point in worrying or getting upset about that? It's not going to help. It's only going to make it worse. You're only going to experience that physical ailment as more and more suffering. It's the aversion or the worry or wanting it to go away. That's what actually produces a huge percentage of our suffering. So if we can let go of that worry, and of course try to resolve the problem if we can, you know, go to a specialist or a doctor or take medication or do whatever we can to overcome the physical illness, sure. But beyond that, if we get caught up in worry and anxiety and fear about it, is that helping in any way? No, it just makes us feel miserable and it makes us suffer more. So we are, on top of the discomforts that is there from the side of the illness, we ourselves are producing more suffering. So in this case, we are our own worst enemy. We are inducing a lot of unnecessary suffering through our fear, worry, or anxiety.
That's
Sorry?
It's very difficult to have control over it.
And that's the same thing, is that we... Very closely related to that is the wanting to control, the need to control. Of course we try to adjust conditions as we can. You know, the law of cause and effect means we can navigate our way through life adjusting causes and conditions. But if we want to control... Yeah, but this is a good point. It's actually the wanting to control that makes us feel out of control. So it's actually counterproductive. So if we can let go of the want or need to control, we'll actually paradoxically feel more in control. It's the wanting to control, the need to control, that makes us feel out of control.
At this moment, you are so immersed with your emotions.
Correct. So therefore...
It's difficult to make a distance.
Exactly. That's why one of the side benefits of this practice is exactly this, is that most people in their life, and I think Alan Wallace mentioned it earlier, is... Exactly, we get caught up in these things, particularly if they're very strong, and we get overwhelmed by them, and we have no way of overcoming them. Whereas if we're doing practice like this, and we're learning to be able to observe our mental events, suddenly we have a bit of breathing space. Suddenly we have a little bit of an opportunity to work with these things and not just simply get overwhelmed by them. So one of the great side benefits of this practice is, again, we will really become the masters of our mind instead of being the slaves of our mind. The, yeah?
But if I, for example, like, it's like a feeling of joy, it's like stable but calm, joy, does it mean it's only some emotion?
No.
And not the basic.
No. What we're going to see coming up in the text a little bit, maybe later today actually, is that when we develop this calm, clear, focused mind, there are three qualities of mind that we see very clearly. Maybe I'll put them up now since we've asked the question. Clarity, that our mind is extremely clear. This is when we achieve shamatha. We'll see the clarity of the mind being very clear. So remember, the other quality we talked about was the stability. In the start of the shamatha, it said a non-discursive single-pointedness. Non-discursive means not anything going on. So we experience that as non-conceptuality. And the third quality we experience is bliss. So these are the qualities of the mind that we experience more and more the more we get to come towards shamatha. So in a state of shamatha, this is what we experience. Now, one more point on that is that as we move forward in our shamatha practice, we're going to start to have a little taste of each one of those. At different times, maybe, or a little bit together. Sometimes our mind is going to seem very clear. Sometimes our mind becomes very quiet and still. Sometimes our mind becomes very joyful or blissful. All of those three experiences are very seductive because they're very nice experiences. So when we start to have these experiences in our shamatha practice, the big tendency can be, of course, is, oh, that's so nice. I want that. And we develop craving for them. And then, of course, they're gone. And then what, unfortunately, many people do is they try to recreate that. It was so nice, that bliss. I want to recreate the bliss. I want to make my mind still. I want to make my mind clear because it's so nice. I want to do that. And then, of course, people try to do that. They get frustrated, they get agitated, and it's a big mess. So in the meditation texts on shamatha, meditation texts are full of warnings to the meditator, warning meditators about these experiences because they're so seductive, that it's so easy to get caught up in them with craving. So rather than get caught up in these with craving and trying to reproduce them in our practice, when we start to have these experiences in meditation, then simply use them as a signpost that our practice is going in the right direction, and use them then, because each one of those puts the mind in a state optimal for shamatha practice. So use them to go deeper into your practice and as a signpost that we're going in the right direction, rather than simply getting caught up in craving those experiences. Otherwise, our practice would come to a grinding halt. And I know from personal experience. Okay. Quick question. We need to... Yeah, quick question, then tea break.
When thought disappears, there is some sense of stupor. Like the body is kind of fixated and almost no mind, something like that.
So when there's...
Dead end or something, I should go back.
Yeah, stupor. Of course, our mind, the second quality, non-conceptuality, means no mental chatter. This can also come if our mind is very heavy and dull. You know, if we're half asleep, there's often not much mental activity going on. Or if it's going on, it's not registering. So if you find that the mind is still, but you feel very the stupor or dullness, it means because clarity is missing. So
No, it's not.
Absolutely. Oh, it's vivid. Then that's fine. That's fine. We can make the mind quite still by, you know, taking some Valium or something, but that's not the goal. You know, we need some clarity. Okay, let's have a tea break, morning tea break, and then we'll come back, do another meditation, and then we'll move into the text again.